morning. My name is Misty, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AAAS Science Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you have already done so, please press the pound sign now. Then press star 1 again to ensure your question is registered. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Natasha Pinnall with AAAS, you may begin your conference.
Hello, I'm Natasha Pinnall, Senior Communications Officer in the AAAS Office of Public Programs. Thank you for joining us today to discuss research by Dr. Armitage and colleagues, which will appear in the journal Science this Friday, the 28th of January. This embargo telebriefing is being made possible today through the generosity of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the nonprofit international society that publishes the journal Science, in cooperation with the University of Tübingen and Royal Holloway, University of London. A reminder that all information disclosed in this teleconference will remain embargoed until 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time or 8 p.m. Central European Time tomorrow, Thursday, the 27th of January, 2011. On the line with me are Dr. Brooks Hansen, Deputy Editor of the Journal Science, and our speakers, who will each give about 3-minute summaries of their primary conclusions. Dr. Hans-Peter Orpan, retired professor of archaeobiology at the University of Tübingen, on the line from Germany. Dr. Anthony Marx, retired professor from the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, on the line from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Dr. Simon Armitage, lecturer in physical geography at Royal Holloway, University of London, also on the line from Germany. And Dr. Adrian Parker, professor of physical geography from Oxford Brookes University, on the line from Germany as well. Dr. Brooks Hansen will first comment on science's perspective in publishing the study, which is entitled The Southern Route Out of Africa, Evidence for an Early Expansion of Modern Humans into Arabia. The study's authors will then participate in the Q&A session following their opening statements. Thanks again for joining us. Brooks?
Thanks again for participating. As Natasha mentioned, I'm Brooks Hansen, Deputy Editor for Physical Sciences at Science. And I'd like to briefly address why science is excited to be publishing the research you'll hear about today. Understanding human evolution requires not just documenting the appearance of the appearances of new species, but also tracing where our ancestors were and when they were there, or when they got there. This is critical for determining what drove our evolution and understanding human ecology, our impact on the environment, and the roots of society and culture. It also informs our understanding of our own genome today. A major question has been when and how modern humans emerged from Africa. It is clear that most of Eurasia, including Australia, was occupied by about 50,000 years ago, but the exodus routes and whether there were much earlier attempts have been much more difficult to discern. These migrations must in turn be closely coupled with our understanding of past climate change, as migrations occurred during glacial cycles, and perhaps glacial times or interglacial times. So these authors describe evidence, and this paper describes evidence, that documents an early migration before 100,000 years ago into Arabia and potentially beyond. These results thus touch on and help tie together all of these larger themes, as well as other recent research in this region. And with that, I'd like to turn, Dr. Hans-Peter Oppmann is the first speaker from among the authors.
Well, I shall read a statement by the directors of the Joint Charger at Tübingen Archaeological Project, which is myself, my wife Margaret, and Dr. Sabah Arjazim from the Directorate of Antiquities of the Sharjah Emirate. And we will talk about the significance of the discoveries at the site called Fai-NA-1 in the Emirate of Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates. The discovery of a site in Southeast Arabia which was occupied by early anatomically modern humans, which I will abbreviate AMH in the following, fills a deep gap in our knowledge about the appearance of our own species outside Africa, where our ancestors originated some 200,000 years ago. A stretch along the shorelines of the Indian Ocean from East Africa through Arabia into South Asia and from there to East Asia and Australia has been discussed, particularly in science, since several years. Our site in the desert interior of the United Arab Emirates was known to the joint archaeological team of the Sharjah Directorate of Antiquities and the Institute of Early Prehistory of Tübingen University for some time as a nice, shady picnic place for a weekend without archaeology. It took some time till we realized that the lack of stone artifacts on the surface there was actually the key to its importance. Contrary to the areas around, no stone tools were to be found in the front of the sheltered area. In fact, they were covered by layers of sand and gravel which had accumulated since the Stone Age. Systematic excavations, generously funded and supported by the government of Sharjah, started in 2003. Paleolithic levels were first reached in 2005 after digging through a sequence from pre-Islamic to Neolithic levels. From the 2006 season onward, the site was in the focus of the joint Sharjah-Tübingen archaeological project. The first significant find, a rough out of a hand axe, recognizable as Paleolithic for every archaeologist, was made on the 7th of March in 2006. This was not what we had expected, because finds of hand axes, common in other parts of Arabia, farther south and west, are almost non-existing in the Emirates and northern Oman. This find made us aware that we were dealing with something that was not only of regional importance. Anthony Marks, a renowned specialist for the African and Near Eastern Paleolithic, and with him Vitaly Uzhik from Kiev, a leading specialist for the typology and technology of Paleolithic stone tools, became involved in the study of the finds. Adrian Parker, already participating in the evaluation of our earlier investigations at Neolithic sites, took over the paleo-environmental aspects. He involved Simon Armitage as a specialist for luminescence dating. Only in their combination, the results of this group of researchers now published in Science provide the fundamental importance of our findings at Phi-NE1. These findings will stimulate further research in Paleolithic archaeology and anthropology, as well as in paleogenetics and related fields. They might also help to shift the focus of this research to areas farther away from Europe and the Mediterranean basin, where anatomically modern humans arrived at a somewhat later time. I will now hand on to Tony Marks.
Let me explain how Vitaly Utsik and I, as Paleolithic archaeologists, came to our conclusions about three Phi assemblages. First, each assemblage was studied to determine what stone tools were present and, just as important, what techniques were used to produce them. These studies showed that assemblages A and B were similar, but assemblage C, the lowest, was radically different. Assemblages A and B tools were made by a non-Levallois unifacial flake technique. On the other hand, the tools in assemblage C were made by a combination of mainly bifacial reduction with some blade and radial Levallois technique. There were two possibilities for assemblage C. First, that it was made by local people who had been there for a long time and who would have left similar artifacts around the landscape. Or, second, it was made by people moving into the area. Since assemblage C was 120,000 years old, we looked at what was in southeastern Arabia at that time. There was literally nothing. Long before 120,000 in western Arabia, there was what we call the Acheulean, but it had disappeared about a half million years ago, leaving a 400,000-year gap between it and assemblage C. Thus, it seemed that assemblage C was made by people coming from somewhere outside southern Arabia, either from the north or from the west. A comparison of contemporaneous Paleolithic assemblages from the north showed they totally lacked the bifacial tool production found at assemblage C, and their Levallois technique was quite different. Thus, they were unrelated. In East Africa, however, there were contemporaneous Paleolithic assemblages that not only used bifacial techniques to make some of their tools, but also used the other two techniques, blade production and radial Levallois. An origin in East Africa for assemblage C people, therefore, was most plausible, based on the stone tools and how they were made. The same approach was taken for the assemblages A and B. Both were very distinct from contemporaneous assemblages dating between 70 and 40,000 years ago in the Near East, East Africa, and even Western Arabia, both in the way tools were made and in the kinds of tools produced. These marked differences led us to conclude that assemblages A and B developed locally and in basic isolation. Simon, it's your turn.
Simon Armitage, Royal Holloway, University of London. As you've just heard from Tony, one of the reasons that we can draw archaeologically interesting conclusions about the stone tools found at Jebel Fire is that we know how old they are. And my responsibility within the project was to generate ages for those tools. I did this using a technique called optically stimulated luminescence dating. In essence, this is a technique which allows us to determine the time which has elapsed since sand grains were last exposed to sunlight. The stone tools at Jebel Fire were found buried within sediments consisting of rock and sand. It's likely that the sand grains were either blown or washed into the site, and so immediately before they buried the stone tools, the sand grains would have been exposed to sunlight. Because of this, we can use optically stimulated luminescence dating to work out how long ago the tools were buried, and therefore how old they are. At this point, it's probably worth considering how luminescence dating works. When a sand grain is buried, it's exposed to very low levels of naturally occurring radiation from the surrounding sediments. Some of the energy from this radiation is stored within the sand grains in the form of electrons which have been detached from their parent atoms. These electrons are referred to as being trapped within the mineral crystal. If a grain is then exposed to sunlight again, the electrons are untrapped, move back to their initial position within the sand grain, and in doing so, they emit a tiny amount of light called luminescence. So, if we imagine a sand grain being blown about by the wind, it's constantly being exposed to sunlight, and hence there's no opportunity for trapped electrons to accumulate. However, once the sand grain stops moving and is buried, it's shielded from sunlight, and electrons, trapped electrons, do begin to accumulate. If instead of exposing the sand to sunlight once again, we take a sample back to the laboratory and measure luminescence it emits under carefully controlled conditions, we can calculate the total amount of natural radiation that has been absorbed and therefore the length of time that the sand grain has been buried for. A rechargeable battery provides a useful analogy for the underlying principle of luminescence dating. If we put a fully discharged battery into a charger, the battery begins to accumulate charge. As time progresses, the stored energy increases. So if we remove the battery from the charger and measure the accumulated charge, we can work out how long the battery has been charging for from the accumulated charge and the charging rate. In this analogy, the battery represents the sand grain, the accumulated charge represents the luminescence signal, and the charging rate represents the natural radioactivity. So, by making luminescence measurements at my laboratory in Royal Holloway, I was able to calculate that assemblage C dated back to about 125,000 years ago. Timing of events is very important in archaeology. In many ways, archaeology without ages is like a jigsaw with the interlocking edges removed. You have lots of individual, interesting pieces of archaeological information, but you can't fit them together to produce the big picture. At Jebel Fire, the age for assemblage C has allowed Tony and Vitaly to infer that the site was occupied by people originating in East Africa. This inference is supported by the unusual climatic conditions that occurred on the Arabian Peninsula around 125,000 years ago, as Adrian Parker will explain next.
Hello, Adrian Parker, Department of Anthropology and Geography, Oxford Brookes University. Simon has outlined how the archaeological layers described by Tony were dated. My role in the project was to determine what the climate and environment were like at the time Jebel Fire became occupied. It was important to establish how modern humans managed to leave Africa and reach the site and to identify the main obstacles in the landscape that needed to be crossed. In order to reconstruct the environment, I compared climate records preserved in the landscape from ancient lakes and rivers, sand dunes, and cave stalagmites. Changes in sea level for the Red Sea were also compared against these records. By piecing together these lines of evidence, detailed changes in climate and landscape through time can be made to determine when it was wet and Arabia could be crossed, or when it was arid and Arabia could not. First, though, we need to go back to where modern humans emerged in East Africa. This occurred approximately 200,000 years ago. The period between 200,000 years ago until 130,000 years ago corresponds to a time when there was a global ice age. During ice ages, global sea levels fall as water becomes locked up in the vast ice sheets in the northern and southern hemispheres. When ice ages occur, the world's major desert belt also expands, and thus modern humans would have been restricted to East Africa, as the deserts of the Sahara and Arabia posed major geographical barriers that prevented movement out of the region. By 130,000 years ago, global climatic conditions changed, and we moved into an interglacial, a period of warmer global temperatures. At this time, the Indian Ocean monsoon system was forced northwards, bringing rainfall into Arabia. The previously arid interior of Arabia would have been transformed into a landscape covered largely in savanna grassland with extensive lakes and river systems. At the onset of the interglacial, sea levels in the southern Red Sea were over 100 meters lower than today. This led to a brief window of time when sea levels were still low and Arabia experienced a wetter climate. Thus, humans would have been able to cross a much narrower Red Sea, perhaps as little as 4 kilometers wide, before sea levels rose sufficiently to make the crossing more difficult. Once they'd crossed into Arabia, they dispersed across the landscape and reached Jebel Fire by 125,000 years ago, as outlined by Tony through the lithics and Simon through the dating. I'm now going to hand you over to Professor Hans-Peter Erdmann for some concluding remarks.
This is Hans-Peter Erdmann again. It has to be remarked that our paper is based on artifact evidence only. The Arabian sands are a quite unfavorable environment for the preservation of skeletal remains. If the artifacts found at Jebel Fire were made by moderns, however, they indicate that no particular cultural achievements were necessary for people to leave Africa. It was rather the environmental development from a glacial to an interglacial period which made range expansion into South Arabia possible. Another window opened shortly after this event. Increasing monsoon during the full interglacial enabled hunter-gatherers to cross the desert separating South Arabia from Southeast Arabia. The drop in sea level during the subsequent cooler period provided an opportunity to reach Proto-Mesopotamia, extending much farther into what is now the Persian Gulf and the Iranian coast, along which the Indus Valley and the Indian subcontinent could be reached. We should add that the Levant is also connected to South Arabia by a corridor along the Red Sea, and that the early moderns found at Kafsi and Hul may also have taken the route through Arabia and not along the Nile. The full scope of potential conclusions which may derive from our findings cannot be foreseen at the time being. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now we'll open the call for a question and answer session with the authors. Operator?
At this time, if you would like, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as it will remove your request from the queue. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Joe Hall with the Toronto Star.
Hi, thank you very much for having this. I just wondered, how far back does this pull the migration out of Africa of modern anatomic and modern humans from what was previously thought?
Well, some 20,000 years at least.
Okay, and do you have a theory as to what happened to the descendants of these tool makers? Did they move on, or did they get isolated in the desert as the seas began to climb and that sort of thing?
Well, that's a very difficult question for an archaeologist, because we only can speak about the site that we are dealing with, and not with where these people would have gone. But as you can easily imagine, the route to the north was easier than the route back to the south, because the desert there would have become worse in that period of time. So the natural answer to your question would be that they moved towards the Persian Gulf, which was smaller then, and along the Gulf, either towards the northwest into Mesopotamia, or towards the east along the Iranian coast into the Indus Valley and the Indian subcontinent.
Thank you very much.
And your next question comes from the line of Dan Barragato with U.S. Today.
USA Today.
Thanks for the correction. I have two questions. I was wondering, first, could you talk a little bit more about what gives you confidence that the bifacial lithics that you're describing are of sort of an African technological origin and not tied to ones you see in Eurasia, you know, from earlier times? How can you be confident that these are African? And second, I'm just to be clear, are you saying that the descendants of modern-day humans are tied to the people who made these tools because, you know, there's genetic data showing this earlier, more recent, origin for out of Africa for modern humans?
Well, the first question goes to Tony Marks.
Well, there are two ways of looking at artifacts and relationships. One is what is there, and then what isn't there. Now, in the case of the bifacial reduction at Fine, if we compare it to what was in the rest of Eurasia, within reasonable distance, let's say not north of the Black Sea, starting at about 200,000 years ago, and possibly quite a bit earlier, there is not a sign of any bifacial reduction in the Levant, in the Zagros, anywhere. Bifacial reduction essentially disappears at the end of what is called the Abrudian, and in the Abrudian there's almost none of it anyway. On the other hand, in East Africa and Northeast Africa, bifacial reduction is a constant part of the technology of people. And it's not just the bifacial reduction. It's in Africa they produce hand axes, but also what are called foliates, leaf-shaped bifacial pieces. These simply do not occur in the rest of Southwest Asia. The presence at Faya of a bifacial foliate and a number of preforms for foliates means that either you have a connection to East Africa or you have an independent invention of this technique from a group that has no history in the area. So it just appears out of nowhere. And therefore, the combination of technologies used, the presence of the foliates, all point to Africa rather than to the north.
So the foliates we should point to is sort of the key lithics, I guess.
In terms of typology, yes. I am much more happy with technology, that is, the way tools are made. And there, the combination of Levallois blade and bifacial reduction is, in fact, at that period, unique to Africa.
Okay. Well, the second part of the question was in terms of genetics, and I will answer that. insofar as I can say that genetics do not really give an absolute time frame. Genetics can only tell us which event happened before another or after another. And the estimates of time are very rough. There is a lot of experience with that now. In the beginning, the domestic dog was said to be 120,000 years old. Now it's 20,000, both based on genetic evidence. And you can imagine how variable the genetic dating is. So the genetic dating, although it may contradict to our results, is by less much less reliable than our dates, which Philip Armitage provided.
So you do see the people who made these tools as perhaps descendants of modern our ancestors.
They are our ancestors. I have no doubt about that.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Charles Cho with Life Science.
Hello. Thank you very much for talking with me about this. So I have two questions. First, when it comes to these dates here and this site here, how might it give us cause to rethink other sites or other hominids such as the Neanderthals or the Denisovans or of India and Europe? And my second question was has to do with genetics, but in a slightly different way. I mean, the nuclear DNA, from what I understand, would seem to support this earlier out of Africa, expansion. But it's the mitochondrial DNA that suggests an out of Africa date of about 60 to 70,000 years ago. So, I was wondering if you had any kind of thoughts on that.
Well, to start with the last question first, I think the mitochondrial DNA has a completely different way of being transferred from one generation to the next. So the contradicting results are not surprising, and this is something that geneticists can probably discuss at a much larger scale. But in any case, our findings in Southeast Arabia and the possibility that humans spread into South Asia very early provides another background for the genetic development, which has to stimulate thinking among the geneticists, and I think they will come up with better answers to your question as I could at the beginning. Could you please repeat your first question?
So the first question was, how might these earlier out of Africa dates, influence what we think about, say, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, or with sites such as, sites in Europe or India, for instance?
Well, the Neanderthals must have come out of Africa earlier than the modern humans, according to what we know about them. And this may have happened on the same route, but this is something we still have to discover. We can't speak about that yet.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to India, obviously, Michael Petraglia and his colleagues have done a lot of work on India. How might this influence what we know there?
Well, I think they can reconsider the evidence in the light of our findings, and I know that they already started to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. May we have another question, please?
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Mark Kaufman with Washington Post.
Some of my questions were already answered, but I was hoping that maybe you could give us a big picture here in terms of what this finding tells us in general or in a broader sweep about the out-of-Africa migrations. Generally, we think about it in terms of what, perhaps this is just because we're a Western nation, in terms of what then happened in Europe, but I guess what you're saying is that the out of Africa was going in a lot of different directions, but in terms of both the timing and the direction, can you tell us what now is different in terms of understanding than it was before?
Well, the mechanisms of getting out of Africa should be understood in a different way. Up to now, we thought of cultural developments leading to the opportunity of people to move out of Africa. Now we see, I think, that it was the environment which was the key to this, and the change from a glacial period into an interglacial opened the possibility to leave Africa through the southern corridor. And this certainly not only happened once, this happened many times during the Quaternary. And this leaves a lot of possibilities for human migrations, and keeping this in mind might change our view completely.
Okay, and is that, are we speaking here of both the migration to Europe and then also to Eurasia?
Yeah, that's all connected. There are not many exits from Africa. You can only exit via the Sinai or via the south. That's the only point where you can leave it. So either it's the route that we propose, or it could be the route from Egypt to Sinai, and both are possible, both have their problems. In any case, our findings open a second way, which in my opinion is more plausible for massive movements than the northern route.
And I'm sorry, a final question. So what you're saying is that the route that you described could also have been the route that then brought people, modern humans, into Europe?
Surely, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Nicholas Wade with the New York Times.
Can I push you just a little more on the question of who made these tools? It probably is a little hard to be definite if one doesn't have any fossils. And for tools this primitive, it's difficult to assign them to their maker, especially as similarities may result from convergence. So I think Dr. Wortmann said he had no doubt that these people were our ancestors. But is that a feeling that everyone shares, that we can really be sure that, beyond doubt, that these are modern humans, behaviorally modern humans?
Well, I think we can never be sure of anything that's only based on one single site up to now. I think what our findings just open our views and tell us where to look for further evidence. And at this point, we really can only speculate. This is nothing that we can say with any certainty. This is simply a point in archaeological research which we have to overcome. But perhaps Tony Marks can tell you more about that.
This is Tony Marks. We can look at it from a broad point of view. If these tools were not made by modern men, who might have made them? Well, could Neanderthals have made them? Well, at 120,000 years ago, that is the beginning of the interglacial, Neanderthals had pretty well developed their facial characteristics and body characteristics to be recognizable as Neanderthals. They're not yet classic Neanderthals, but they're mainly in Europe. At about the beginning of the last interglacial, there's a movement, a spread of Neanderthals along the temperate zone to the east. That is the Crimea, southern Russian plain, out to Central Asia. There is no evidence for any Neanderthals south of that temperate zone to the east. It is only in OIS-4, that is when it starts getting cold, that you have movements of Neanderthals out of the highlands of the temperate zones down into the Levant, into lower elevations where the environment is better. To suggest that, well, here is an exception. Here is a group of Neanderthals who, instead of going into this temperate zone, which was getting better, they took a turn south, went several thousand kilometers into what at the time was desert, really dry areas. until they reached southern Arabia, which happened to be very good because of monsoons that were coming up from the south. It seems to me a very difficult explanation, and one that is doesn't follow any reasonable logic.
You're saying it's modern humans by exclusion.
Well, that's in terms of fossil distributions, yes.
Oh, okay, so can I ask a second question?
In terms of artifacts, no, positive associations.
Okay. May I ask a second question? In these climatic changes, as you described, Africa expands. One can consider the African ecological zone expanding to include both Israel with the school and Catholic cave and also southern Arabia. So could one then ask the question, is this an expansion of modern humans or rather an expansion of Africa? It could be just an expansion of Africa unless one can show that modern humans from this migration progress further. So how should we look at that question? In other words, unless you have expansion beyond this ecological region, this is not necessarily an expansion of modern humans.
Peter, do you want to deal with that?
Well, I think I may not have understood the question correctly. You speak of an expansion of Africans separate from an expansion of modern humans, if I understood you correctly.
Yes, if this is just the African ecological zone expanding, then in a climatic sense, you know, we still have humans in Africa. It's only if they go beyond this.
Well, this could be true in a geographical sense, in a biogeographical sense, for the south of Arabia, for what is now the Yemen. But it is not true for Southeast Arabia, where our site is, because this is separated and belongs to an Asian faunal territory. So it is a movement out of Africa, really, in the true sense.
Oh, okay.
Add one thing here? Without doubt, we cannot, and nobody else can, show a series of points on a map showing modern Homo sapiens moving from East Africa to Australia or East Africa to Europe. They certainly got to both places. But to track them archaeologically would be extremely difficult. And what we have been able to do here is a first step. We have gotten them beyond, as you say, the African environmental zone.
Okay.
To the north, the people at school and Kapsa, first of all, never seem to have gotten any farther. Their specific technology and culture, which we could recognize archaeologically, is not found in Anatolia, for instance. It's interestingly, as well, not found in the Negev, in the southern Levant. These people seem to have gotten as far as the Carmel and not gotten any farther.
Well, don't both these limited expansions tell us, if you combine them with the genetics, that neither really led further? Because the genetics surely is telling us a very simple story, which the real expansion came later, 60 to 40,000 years ago, and these two earlier ones didn't go any further.
Well, this is different kind of evidence that you use. One is archaeological and the other is genetics. And as I told earlier, genetics do not really give you a chronology. They give you a sequence of happenings, but they cannot really say how and when, how early these events happened. So the genetic chronology is not something that we can compare to the chronology produced by Simon Armitage. So our chronology is certainly better than any genetic chronologies are.
I agree one should always believe an archaeological date over a genetic date, but there is such extensive work with the mitochondrial DNA, and the coalescence date has always been 60,000 years. It still seems hard to dismiss it, or at least surely the most economical interpretation is that it's showing that the real expansion was at a younger date than the two sort of semi-expansions we now have, the one from Cassius school and the second yours.
Excuse me, this is Tony Marks. If we take this 60,000-year expansion and we say, okay, instead of looking at it from a genetic point of view, let's look at it from an archaeological point of view. What were these people carrying in the way of culture at 60,000 years ago in Africa? And can you find it any place outside of Africa? And the answer is no, you can't. There is no archaeological evidence for movements at 60,000 out of Africa. Now, it may turn up next year, but at the moment, it's simply not there.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. At this time, there are no questions. Operator, let's re-prompt. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. I think we have a few questions that reporters would like to ask, so we'll just hold on the line here. Your next question comes from the line of Ian Sample with Guardian newspaper.
Hi, a very, very simple one for you. How do you think these guys crossed the straits, and what sort of world would they have found on the other side in terms of the climate, the kind of animals they would have been sort of living alongside, what sort of food resources would they have had there? Can you comment on stuff like that?
You mean the Straits of Bab el-Mandab?
Yep.
Well, the two sides of the Straits are fairly similar in terms of climate, so there is no difference in that regard. The fauna that could be used by people would have been much poorer in species on the Arabian side, because many species would not have been able to get over into Arabia. But this doesn't mean that there was less prey available, because those animals who were there, they would have taken advantage of the climate amelioration, and they would have been there in great numbers. So what could have been hunted then down there is the oryx antelope, for example, the wild ass, gazelles, several species of them, then typical Arabian animals like the mountain ibex, and things like that. So there would have been plenty of prey available, and the plant community would have been fairly similar to the African one. So these people would not have had to adapt a lot. It would have become more difficult when they went further north east, because there it gets quite dry, and that's the other bottleneck through which they had to go, and then on the other side of that in Oman, they would have gotten better things again.
And how might they have gotten across? I'm not sure how deep a straits we're talking about.
Well, there is even a possibility that the straits were passable at low tide. It was never completely closed, though, which is visible from the deep sea course in the Red Sea, that there are no evaporites in there. but the straits may, at the maximum sea level regression, have been as narrow as 1 kilometer, some people say, and what we assume is between 4 and 5 kilometers, but that is, should not be difficult for people dealing with the East African lakes.
So they walked across?
No, well, they could maybe have walked across, but it's not necessary that we postulate that. They could have used rafts or boats, which they certainly could make at that time.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Robert Hope with the Wall Street Journal.
Hello, operator. It looks like we're having some technical difficulty.
Mr. Hotz, your line is open, sir.
Yes, I'm sorry. Here I am. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you for your patience. What I'm asking is if you could just give us some more sensory detail, if you like, about the conditions of the site today, the conditions of excavation. And then for my readers who are not as attuned to the nuances of the technical aspect of tool making, I wonder if you could give us a more general lay idea of the kinds of tools that you found and what is about them that makes them so distinctive that you are willing to hinge this rather remarkable interpretation on them.
Well, I give you for the first part of the question to Adrian Parker.
Hello. The site today is located in the exterior of the Emirate Sharjah, and it has an annual rainfall today of about 100 millimetres per year. In winter, temperatures are probably down to about 15 degrees Celsius, and in the summer they probably get up to as warm as 45, maybe 50 degrees Celsius.
I'm sorry, Dr. Parker. Unfortunately, we're having difficulty hearing you. Operator, could we bring up the audio level?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Hello, can you hear me now?
That's better.
Okay, you were asking about what the environmental conditions at the site are like today.
Correct.
So the modern day climate.
Yes, sir.
Yes, the site's located about 65 kilometres inland from the coast of the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean. The site has an annual rainfall of about 100 millimetres per year, so it is classified as arid to hyper-arid today. The summer maximum temperature probably gets up as high as 45 to 50 degrees Celsius during the day, and the winter maximum temperature is probably about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius. Site is right on the edge of the Rubakali Sand Sea, which is the largest global sand sea in the world, which covers approximately 600,000 square kilometres. It's on an outlier of the Hajar Mountains with a gravel plain to the east, and it's separated from the main mountain front by about 20 kilometres. However, what is interesting is although it's hyper-arid, they do get a little bit of winter rainfall. And when it does rain on the gravel plain very close to the site, it becomes very green very quickly. So you can get a good idea of what the landscape might have been like. So you've got acacia trees, and you do get a very quick greening of the landscape when you do get winter rain. Is there any other detail that you'd like about today?
I wonder, in terms of the contemporary scene, I mean, just tell us a little bit about the site itself. I mean, we know that there are several levels. I mean, what have you exposed? What does it look like?
Okay, it's a collapsed rock shelter.
Uh-huh.
The site. Within the rock shelter sediments, a trench extends about 24, 25 metres out from the back wall, going down as far as about 5 metres in depth. And on the site, there are successive levels of sands and gravels some of which are artifacts, various successes, successions of occupation, and they are separated from one another with sterile sediments showing phases when the site wasn't being occupied. And at the moment, the site, the trenches are still open, and the government of Sharjah, I believe, are trying will be preserving the site for future people to be able to come and see.
Thank you.
Operator, I think we have time for two or three more questions.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request from the queue. Your next question comes from the line of Charles Cho with Life Science.
Hi, I was wondering, when you first, you know, could you talk about some of the difficulties that you might have had, you know, when it came to, working at the site? I mean, there's the extreme heat. Was there any extreme weather or, you know, venomous animals or anything like that? And also, when you first realized the significance of the site, how did you feel?
Well, the last question is the easiest. Very excited, because it was obvious that we had found the first stratified Paleolithic site in a large area. In terms of the other experiences with the site, I can tell you that once a camel fell into a trench and we had trouble with the Bedouins. But otherwise, the area is very safe and no problems at all with the locals who come and are very interested. And so working there is quite agreeable, in particular because of the very favorable support given to us by the government.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Please refrain from using the pound sign, as this will remove your request. At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, I want to thank the panelists for participating today and the reporters. A reminder that the paper and related materials are embargoed until tomorrow, Thursday, the 27th of January, 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time or 8 p.m. Central European Time. Audio files and a transcript of this briefing and a related news piece will be posted on the SciPac website this afternoon, where the paper and the related materials are housed. If you have any further questions, please contact me or the Science Press team at 202-326-6440. Thank you.
This concludes today's AAAS Science Conference Call. You may now disconnect.